My word.
A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is Michael O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another bout of competitive wordplay between our two teams of compulsive word players, Dilys Powell and Frank Muir. And Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norden. Now we're going to start with a brief voyage round their vocabulary, hoping not to run aground. Frank, what's the meaning of abecedary? A-B-E-C-E-D-A-R-Y.
It's somebody who teaches you your alphabet.
They're getting very near to it. Something they might use to teach you your...
Dictionary.
Yeah, a dictionary would be an abecedary.
Then I rest my case.
Yes. Well, 1.5. No, 1.6, I think you've got so far.
Mary's blinched.
Yes, our scorer has now gone decimal. It's a type of book.
It's a sort of book which is in alphabetical order.
Well done. The extra point for squeeze out 2 marks of Frank. Antonia, a spandrel. What is a spandrel? S-P-A-N-D-R-E-L.
Well, I think I'm right. It's you see them in cathedrals, don't you?
Yes, indeed.
And it's one of the sort of punctuations of Gothic architecture.
It's an architectural feature.
Yes, yes. You've put that very well.
I think we'll give you a mark and put you out of your agony and say it's that odd triangular bit outside the outer bit of the arch. I'm having to draw it in the air. It's like a spiral staircase between the arch and a horizontal wall that's alongside it. It's the little triangular bit. Dilys, what's the meaning of basilisk? B-A-S-I-L-I-S-K.
Basilisk is a kind of mythical creature.
Indeed.
If you look at it, I think you fall down dead.
Indeed.
So I hope there are none round.
That's Well, we give you your 2 marks. Do you know what sort of a creature it was?
What sort?
Yes, well, I mean, had it got legs or a tail or horns?
Well, I've never seen one. That's why I'm here.
Oh, dear, yes. There's 2 marks for getting the answer and an extra mark for killing the chairman. It was, in fact, a reptile, a mixture between... It was a serpent that had been hatched out of a cock's egg, which you can't get more mythical than that. Dennis, the meaning of rumble gumption. R-U-M-B-L-E-G-U-M-P-T-I-O-N.
It's one of those words which is obviously not an important word, so nobody gets offended if you get it wrong. No professions or minority groups or... rumble gumption. I would think it's having the sense to know when your stomach thinks it's time to have something to eat.
That's 2 marks. Yeah. 2 marks. Well, in fact, 3 marks. I think you get a bonus for that because you've particularised it. Because it really just means common sense, and I can't think of a better
example. I got the gumption, but I couldn't make out what the rumble was.
Yes, it's rumble gumption, common sense now. It's another of those words. Well done. Now, before we move on to our next round, let me give you the quotations that Frank and Dennis have been given for the last round. And Frank's is In Memoriam, which is a poem by Tennyson, or a column in our local newspaper. And Dennis, All the News Fit to Print, which is the motto of the New York Times, attributed to the publisher Adolf Ox. I think it's Ox, O-C-H-S. Meanwhile, we'll have a round of technical terms. To what sphere of human, commercial, or mechanical activity do the following words or phrases properly belong? Frank, this is your collection. To dodge, to go into a slow hunt, to call in the middle with a double.
Call her in the middle. Call her in the middle. It's darts. To dodge means you've got a couple of pints of beer and you walk between the dartsman and the board. That's to dodge. To go into a slow hunt is when you drop your dart, when people have been walking around, and you've got to crawl under the tables and look for it and replace the flight. And call her in the middle.
With a double.
Call her in the middle with a double. Well, it's when you suddenly realise it's getting late and you break off before the conclusion of the game to telephone your wife.
Well, it's all wrong, of course, but you've got 2 marks. I wasn't going to stop you.
What's your story?
Marks for adventure.
What's your story?
My story is to do with campanology.
What?
Or what we doctors call bell ringing. And they're descriptions of the sequences in which bells are rung in a peal. Anyway, we gave you 2 marks, Frank, because I thought your answer was better than the one I had in front of me. Antonia, here's you've just got 2 here. A hysterical historical and a bodice ripper.
Well, a bodice ripper is a delightful form of fiction in which the bodice generally of thin silk, which makes it easier for the hero to rip it, although he is so manly, he could actually rip fustian. Nevertheless...
Sailcloth.
Nevertheless, silk is all he's presented with. And I leave it to your imagination what happens after he's ripped it. That's one. And I think historical must be another form of historical novel.
Now, they both mean the same thing, actually. I think Peter Moore, who sets these questions, got rather carried away in his description, but it's nice. He says, both define fantasized 18th or 19th century romantic novels salted with sex and violence, but sanitized with frills and furbelows. I think we'll give Peter a mark, won't we, for that. Dillis, where do these come from? A glitch, a glork, to gronk, and to grovel.
Well, they're all words, so that naturally I'm extremely familiar. I think that they're sort of swear words which have been rather kept from the purity of my ears. Sort of say, oh, really, glitch, gronk off. Is that right?
No, but you like Frank, you've won your 2 marks for outdoing the original. I think they're much better. They in fact come from the only language in which my 15-year-old son is fluent.
Mongolian. Oh, I know.
You know.
It's a computer.
Computer.
Oh, it is, right. Yes, they come from computers.
You are gifted.
And they...
Well, a 15-year-old is a giveaway.
Yes, well, I was trying to be helpful, but you got your 2 marks for being so inventive. They're terms to do with various incomprehensible things about computers. Dennis, 2 phrases. To dangle the Dunlops. And to top up for Mum and Dad.
I don't know. It's Dunlop, and top up for Mum and Dad. It's tennis or motor car.
They're to do with tyres, but not motor car tyres.
Oh, well, I don't.
I think I'll put you tires. Out.
They use it in swimming baths sometimes. Tyres in lions' cages, they leap through.
Flaming.
They're not lion tamers jargon, are they?
Aircraft
tyres.
Aircraft tyres.
Aircraft.
Lowering the undercarriage.
Well done, yes. Frank's got himself. Yeah. What about to top up for Mum and Dad? It's civil aviation, so your wartime...
Presumably blowing up the... Don't work. Inflating the tyres.
No, nothing to do with tyres.
Oh.
It's petrol.
I would hope you'd tell me, because I'll tell you what it says. And it says, to take on extra fuel to allow for a diversion from a suspect airfield. Now, what is a suspect airfield? I wanted to know. Anyway, that's...
Luton.
Anyway, Dennis, everyone scored marks for invention on that round. Well done. Now we move on to a round of hats. Frank, describe the type of hat which became eponymous that was sported in Paris by a Miss O'Farrell.
It's made of hard felt. With a straight brim, and it had a dent in the top, yes. Rather like half a hot-cross bun.
But it was sort of soft felt, actually.
Soft felt, yes.
And was called?
A trilby.
Well done. As worn by?
Miss Trilby.
Well done. 2 marks to Frank. Antonia, for what reason did a hat, the property of Herr Gessler, an Austrian bailiff, inspire Schiller to write a play and Rossini an opera?
Well, the answer's William Tell. Mm. And I suppose the hat, what was it? They shot through the hat and then he had to put the apple on his boy's head.
No, it's William Tell...
To keep the doctor away.
William Tell gets you... You're halfway there, gets you 1 mark. But the hat came in...
He shot at the... In some way, he either snatched the hat. He was a subversive, a dissident, yeah. William Tell. And he did something to the hat.
Well, he didn't do something to
the hat. That's right. He refused to take off his hat.
No. I can't really...
He refused not to take off his hat.
He refused not to take off his hat, as Frank said. But I know the punishment so well.
Yes, we all know the punishment. But the offence is what we're after. The offence was he declined to salute the hat that was on a pole Gessler put there. Anyway, 1 mark for William Tell. Dillis, why is a wide-awake hat, the hat with a large, you know, the wide floppy brim, the wide-awake hat, why is it called that, do you know?
Well, extraordinary as it may seem, I do know. Yes, I know. It's called wide-awake because it was made of some kind of felt which didn't take a nap.
That's right. Never had a nap. Yeah. Well done. I really think that deserves an extra mark.
It's rather jolly, isn't it?
Because it's a real knight's move, that, isn't it? Wide awake hat.
Wide awake.
Never had a nap. Well done. Dennis, from a scrutiny of a battered billycock hat, Mr. Sherlock Holmes was able to deduce, or Basil Rathbone, when I saw him, was able to deduce that its owner was unlikely to have gas in his house.
We once went through all the Sherlock Holmes short stories, Frank and I, when we were writing a Sherlock Holmes parody in order to find out, to construct some of these deductions ourselves. And they're very, very difficult to do. And the one we got actually involved, which was that the man came in, we made it sort of up to date, and he said, "I see you have been to the cinema." And I said, you know, Watson says, how did you know that? And he said, "Because you have chocolate in the crown of your hat." but I can't remember what happened to why the clue of the billycock hat.
Is it wax in it?
Well, yes, then, so he wouldn't have had gaslight because he'd have had...
Candles,
or he'd had lit the candles with a bulb.
And... He had candle wax on his hat and therefore didn't have gas laid on, it says. Well done. 2 marks for Dennis. Grease from a tallow candle. Comes from his medical book, The Blue Carbuncle, that one. Ah. Now we come to the round of Frank and Dennis's quotations. And Frank, let's see how you get on with In Memoriam.
Wonderful, meaningful poem by Tennyson. And when Tennyson was asked, in the body of his work, which of his poems brought him most personal satisfaction, he always used to reply, "In Memoriam." I can't do the worst. And now, if I have a fault, which I haven't, it is modesty. And the other day, I said to myself, "Frank, CBA, isn't it strange how well your career as a professional singer on the BBC has gone?"
And it is true, you know. I didn't know I was destined to be a singer of renown for the Broadcasting Corporation. I suppose it all started when I won a prize. I was aged 7 on the beach at Broadstairs. And it was a contest at Uncle Mac's. And I stood up and I sang. I remember the song to this day. It went, Constantinople, C-O-N-S-T-A-N-T-I-N-E-P-L-E. Constantinople, it's as easy to sing as saying ABC. I was an ABC Darian even then. And it was strange that I won it, because it's not an easy song to sing, although the lyric says so, when you've got about a quarter of a pound of Uncle William's toffee in your mouth at the time, which I couldn't get rid of, because I'd started eating it. And Uncle William's toffee, you tapped with a hammer, and it came out triangular, and you... and I sang, Constantinople, spraying the audience with raspberry-flavoured toffee. Much more flavoursome in those days. The only reason I won, I think, looking back, was there were only two entrants. There was I and a small girl, who was even younger than I was, and as she sobbed bitterly, she didn't get anywhere, and I won the prize. And then the producers of My Word suddenly decided to start this musical show, My Music, they were really after capturing Dennis's voice, of course, which, I mean, my voice could be described as a light domestic baritone with vegetable connections. But Dennis, on the other hand, was star material, because the profession reckoned that he sounded like a combination of whispering Jack Smith, Nellie Wallace, and a seagull with its foot caught. because Dennis was singing, they asked me to sing too. And of course, you know, I've been singing for the last 17 years, and the letters I've had, they've been absolutely wonderful. I brought them along, actually, one or two comments. Somebody asked for the name of the producer who finally allowed me to sing on radio. He said, this chap wrote, "Who told you you could sing?" And another chap seemed to think, I don't know why, seemed to think that I was just singing for, not for money at all, but for sweets. He said, "You can't sing for toffee." And very often people rang, over the years, people rang in asking for the name of the song. One chap here said, "What do you call that noise you made last Tuesday?" And I asked Ian Wallace, who sings, you know, he's a professional singer, what he thought of my voice. And he said, and I remember the words exactly, and I never will forget them. He said, "Frank, I think your voice will be remembered when Caruso's and Gilles have been forgotten, and not before." But what I really like singing are the really emotional songs. Blue heaven and you and I and sand kissing a sunburnt thigh. The desert song is calling. Or sophisticated songs. Cole Porter, Just One of Those Things. If we'd sawed a bit off the end of it, I started painting the town. Songs of Nature. Now is the time when the sparrow starts with it along the flight. Or the big sentimental ballad that you feel here. Overhead, the moon is beaming. Bright as blossom on the tree. Naught could be heard but the song of some bird, filling the air with bird seed." What? The only thing that worried me slightly, though, nobody noticed it, and you probably didn't notice it, is that I can't remember the words all that well. And one song I did sing was a song I picked up when I was in New Zealand
which was a Maori war chant, which actually didn't have any words. It went, So if you asked me, looking back on my past triumphs, in which song did I really have full, deep artistic satisfaction, I would have to say, In Me Maui Hum.
Thank you, Frank, for broadening the cultural base of this program. Dennis, let's see what you do with all the news fit to print.
Well, that was, of course, another of Thora Titmarsh's doomed ventures, and I told her so. Mrs. Titmarsh, I said, you will destroy us all. While I entirely support your dedication to the task of transforming Golders Green into the Athens of northwest London, I said, no possible good can come of an attempt to restage the Olympics there. Especially, I went on, if you're serious about having every competitor perform naked. If I may remind you, she said, that is how the races were originally run in ancient Greece, which makes it exactly the kind of noble simplicity I'd like the world to associate with the name of Golders Green. From everyone round that table came a murmur of agreement. Mrs. Titmarsh, you see, as I've had reason to mention before, is our neighbourhood rich person, an imposing lady whose money has enabled her to have everything lifted except her IQ. But as that amenities committee consists mainly of local shopkeepers craving her custom, whatever she proposes generally gets passed 14 in favour, 1 against, the one being me. So, aware of that, and equally aware that Mrs. Titmarsh still hadn't forgiven me for that misguided prank of introducing 6 live salmon into her jacuzzi, I nevertheless persisted. Do you really believe, I said, do you really believe you can get the world's top athletes to come over to Golders Hill Park and compete in the nude? Can you see the Russians agreeing? I mean, just think of some of their lady discus throwers. As for persuading Daley Thompson or Carl Lewis to discard their sponsored shorts, I don't intend to try, said Mrs. T. Golders Green can provide competitors from within our own international community. At which, for the first time, faint traces of unease appeared on the faces of certain committee members, particularly the 3 Italians who own the dry cleaners, the young Indian chap from the corner newsagent, and the 2 Chinese gentlemen who run the kosher delicatessen. And in the event, all their fears, their doubts, were justified, because the Golders Green Nude Olympics turned out to be what I can only describe as a bloodbath. The General Purposes Committee of Golders Green, having categorically refused to let the games take place in any of their open spaces, they were held in a section of Mrs. Titmarsh's own spacious grounds, an area which, when a reporter from the local newspaper saw the competitors emerge for the grand opening march past in a state of what we all began to call full noodle frontity, he immediately christened the place Nothing to Hyde Park. But it was at that point the casualties started, the first being a quite grisly collision between one of the military bandsmen and the naked gymnastic lady marching directly in front of his trombone. From then on, matters simply got more and more painful. I can't think how the ancient Greeks actually managed to perform athletic events while bare. I can only presume that hurdling hadn't been invented yet. And as for what the unprotected human body can do to itself with a pole vault, I can only tell you it's the first time I've ever seen a first aid tent with a house full sign. Probably as bad a moment as any occurred during the men's 5,000-metre relay. I don't think I'll ever forget the unfortunate misunderstanding that arose when it came to handing over the baton. During this particular changeover, one poor fellow got dragged 50 yards. Well, to say that the ranks of Golders Green tradespeople were decimated would be to understate what occurred. In fact, that same local news reporter probably got nearer the truth with what he printed under a photo showing the only two who were left in any condition to take part in the 100 metres, because the caption read, "All the nudes fit to sprint."
Thank you, Dennis. I hope one day Golders Green will put up a statue to you. I see from the score sheet that Dillis and Frank win this week's major prize, which is, of course, an opportunity to come back in our next programme and do battle with Antonia and Dennis. And until then, goodbye.
In My Word, Michael O'Donnell was in the chair. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the programme was produced for the BBC by Tony Shrine and Pete Atkins.